The next case of the morning is number 043377, the United States against Robert McKissick. Mr. Camarena.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Paul Camarena, on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Robert McKissick. Your Honors, the issue in this case is fairly simple. The issue is really whether it is plain error for a district court to impose special conditions of supervised release when that district court has made absolutely no findings about those special conditions and has given absolutely no notice to the defendant about those special conditions. Based on this court's jurisprudence, Mr. McKissick would submit that it is plain error for a district court to impose those special conditions absent any findings and absent any notice. The case of the United States versus Ango is informative in this appeal. In that case, the defendant had a long history of criminal sexual abuse of children. In fact, in that case, he was convicted of soliciting a minor and of possessing child pornography. The district court did not give any notice. Nevertheless, the district court imposed a special condition that the defendant register as a sex offender.
But here's the thing. I mean, a number of circuits have found that if the additional condition is one that is already set out as a permissible discretionary condition in either the statute or the guidelines, and I'm looking at the moment particularly at 3563B, that is notice. And the conditions that the district court judge imposes here are not kind of unusual, tailor-made conditions. They are conditions that are, in fact, already in the statute. Why isn't that enough notice?
Your Honor, I would first point out that when this case was decided, that wasn't and as of right now, it's not the law in this circuit. So, Mr. McKissick.
Well, it's not the law either. I mean, we hadn't quite gone that far.
Well, seeing that it's not. And it's not in the case law, Mr. McKissick and his counsel would not have had notice.
Well, unless you say you just, as a matter of law, don't have notice of things that are in the statute book.
Okay, well, aside from that, Your Honor, the special conditions in this case went beyond what's listed in the guidelines and what's listed in the statute. For example, the statute mentions restrictions on excessive use of alcohol. The guidelines also list that as a special condition. In this case, the district court restricted any use of alcohol.
But how can it be plain error for the district court? So all we're talking about is the difference between excessive use of alcohol and any use, so he's got to stay on the wagon for a few years? I mean, why is that plain error?
Well, Your Honor, aside from giving notice, the district court the special conditions must also be reasonably related to the offense, to the defendant, to deterrence, public protection, or correctional treatment. And he also must involve no greater deprivation of liberty than is reasonably necessary per 18 U.S.C. Section 3583D. In this case, Mr. McKissick would submit that the special conditions, as they are not at all related to the offense or to any relevant conduct, they are not because the court didn't make any findings as to how they involve no less deprivation of liberty than is reasonably necessary, Mr. McKissick would submit that aside from the notice requirement, the imposition of these special conditions would be plain error.
But I mean, I guess you're right. I mean, the district court judge doesn't go on at great length, but she does spend some time talking to Mr. McKissick, saying, you know, that unfortunately he has not managed to stay in the straight and narrow, and things like ask him to get a GED, be employed, do community service, refrain from excessive use, or refrain from all use of alcohol or drugs unless prescribed by a doctor, drug abuse treatment. I mean, these are all things, if he were to do it, perhaps might enhance his chances of living a good life the rest of his life. She says that to him, basically. Where's the Mr. McKissick inside you that's better? Words to that effect.
Perhaps, Your Honor. However, the district court didn't make any findings along those lines. The district court didn't mention any of the special conditions until the special conditions were actually imposed. I would submit that
But do you think these are bizarre conditions? I mean, these all seem like such common sense conditions to me.
Your Honor, I would submit that they're bizarre in the sense that they're not at all related to the offense or to any relevant conduct. Mr. McKissick was robbed a bank. He pled guilty to robbing a bank. The district court accepted that plea. The district court didn't make any findings regarding relevant conduct. Nevertheless, the special conditions relate to alcohol, to community service, to education, and to employment. Unless this court would hold that any criminal defendant is subject to those special conditions, I would submit that there isn't any basis in the record.
But didn't we have a situation here? I can't remember the number of jobs that he lost during a certain period. He was losing jobs, or he quit jobs, or he was fired from jobs, and certainly his education was inadequate. You're not quarreling with those conditions, are you, as well?
Your Honor, I would submit that his educational and employment background is not different than the typical defendant, and the district court didn't make any finding that he would benefit from a GED, a high school education, or from community service.
And you're saying the district court has to make that specific finding, even though under 3563B, various special conditions are noted that are the court's options.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that under this court's jurisprudence, the district court was required to make specific findings. In United States versus Scott, the defendant committed a fraud, and he also used the Internet to obtain child pornography. He pled guilty to the fraud. The district court did not hold the possession of child pornography as relevant conduct. Nevertheless, the district court imposed a special condition prohibiting the defendant from using the Internet. This court noted, and I quote, "The judge did not explain how the no internet condition would be thought to entail no greater deprivation of liberty than is reasonably necessary," and vacated those special conditions. In that case, the special conditions were at least related to the wrongdoing of the defendant. In this case, the special conditions do not relate to any wrongdoing of the defendant, or if they relate to any wrongdoing as far as the alcohol special conditions go, they relate to very minor petty offenses.
Well, let me ask you this. Wouldn't you agree that if the defendant doesn't have, if it turns out he doesn't have a substance abuse problem, he gets tested, he gets evaluated, as the court says, then there would be no treatment? Or if he had some problem, it was a small problem, it's conceivable the treatment would be brief. I guess what I'm asking is, what would be the great harm in imposing in that condition that was imposed?
The record establishes that Mr. McKissick has had limited employment possibilities. He had limited education. Nevertheless, the district court would require Mr. McKissick to actually pay for the rehabilitative treatment without even a finding that he needs alcoholic rehabilitative treatment. I'd also submit that the case of United States versus Smith is informative. In that case, the defendant, who was a truck driver, pled guilty to interstate freight because he stole his employer trucking company's truck contents. There, just like in this case, the district court didn't make any findings of special conditions, but nevertheless imposed the special conditions prohibiting the defendant from driving any trucks. This court found, and I quote, "the absence of a finding that the restriction was necessary troubling," and held that the record did not support the special conditions and vacated the special conditions. I would submit that in that case, the special conditions at least related to the wrongdoing, whereas in this case, the special conditions have absolutely no relation to the offense or to any relevant conduct. And because of that, Mr. McKissick is at least as worthy of relief as the defendants in both Smith and Scott. If Your Honors don't have any questions for me, I would reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Cameron.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Chesley.
May it please the court, this case concerns conditions of supervised release that were imposed by the district court, all of which are contemplated by statute and the sentencing guidelines.
Well, the statute talks about excessive use of alcohol, not no alcohol at all, right?
That's true. There is that distinction.
And so,
it's a significant one.
Pardon me?
Go ahead. Answer Judge Rose.
It is a significant difference.
There is a difference. There's no question about that, Your Honor. And the both the statute and the guidelines do talk about excessive alcohol.
So how is the requirement that the defendant abstain entirely from alcohol reasonably related to his history? There's nothing in the PSI that justifies it.
Well, there are some indications in the pre-sentence report that relate to alcohol. He was first intoxicated when he was 17.
Right.
When he was 18, he was stopped and had open alcohol in an automobile he was driving. He indicated that 1 month prior to the offense in this case, he had been intoxicated, even though he had indicated that he was only a social drinker who drank a few drinks per month.
But here, has the defendant ever been diagnosed with any alcohol or drug abuse problems or any dependencies?
No.
And I guess I'm curious, you know, if the court wanted him evaluated because there was some indication when he was a young man and because of this one incident as an adult, he might have had a problem. Given his financial situation requiring him to pay for the treatment and testing for 5 years, how is that justified, given the history and also his financial situation?
The financial situation, I think, would be difficult for him to pay, but in connection with the other conditions that the court imposed here, getting a GED or high school diploma, getting some type of employment, or things that would assist him in paying for the alcohol testing. In addition, these conditions are not written in stone. These conditions can be modified at any time. 3583 sub E specifically provides that a defendant can seek a modification, and that has happened in the past where with respect to alcohol and drugs. People can get tested. If they don't need treatment, then that condition can be removed.
But on this sort of alcohol thing, isn't the argument you're making kind of circular? Because if he has a problem with alcohol, you know, is he going to be competent to get education to complete his GED and then get a job so he can pay for the,
Well, I don't know that initially he would be able to pay for that. I don't think that would be possible coming out of jail. You're not going to have necessarily a job. But the issue here is whether this is plain error. And I think the imposition of those conditions is not plain error in this situation.
And I just can't recall, in the sentencing order of the court, did the court order treatment for alcohol abuse while he was incarcerated?
Because
that's pretty typical. If there's some real problem that a person has, you would have that evaluation and treatment plan done in prison.
I don't recall, Your Honor. But when we're talking about conditions of supervised release, I think you have to understand that people who have been convicted and are put on supervised release don't have the same degree of freedom that a person who has not been convicted with an offense. The conditions are inherent in supervised release. Some are mandatory, some are discretionary, and the district court has broad discretion in imposing those conditions of supervised release.
That's all true, but I think, of course, we have two issues here. One of them is the notice issue.
Right.
Apart from standard of review, but one of them is the notice issue. The other is whether a particular condition of supervised release is appropriate to Mr. McKissick's situation. And on the notice issue, no matter how much discretion the district court has, if the district court has never heard from the defendant, the district court isn't going to be in a position to exercise that discretion as intelligently. It's possible Mr. McKissick might have had interesting information to present to the court on the alcohol issue, for instance.
Well, certainly notice would have assisted Mr. McKissick in providing information concerning that.
And maybe she would have realized that just the usual excessive alcohol as opposed to absolute ban was appropriate.
That's correct, Your Honor, but the notice provision, the background from that comes from the Burns case, the Supreme Court, that said if you are going to depart, you have to give people notice so that they can contemplate it. I realize that it's the same situation we're talking about here where people have notice and the ability to prepare. Here, all of these conditions are in alcohol conditions. It's only excessive, but all the conditions are related to statutes and sentencing guidelines. So the defendant
does. What if he had been a Mormon and, you know, had never touched alcohol in his life, and nonetheless the district court says you're going to have to pay for alcohol tests for the next 5 years while you're on supervised release and show up once a week at some facility and do all sorts of things? An utter waste of time, given the background of the hypothetical person I'm talking about. You don't have a problem with that?
Well, does that create a miscarriage of justice? That situation, I think, comes much closer to creating a miscarriage of justice or intolerable conditions than we have here. Here we have a defendant who, at the very least, has issues with alcohol.
Well, you say that. I mean, I guess I have trouble, based on this record, characterizing it that way, because it doesn't sound different to me from any college kid I can think of who, you know, get intoxicated from time to time, and some of them, you know, it's like the Casablanca line, some of them do it before they're 21. And I don't know what Mr. McKissick did, aside from that rather common behavior.
The record is what it is, and,
yeah,
and
I've related. Skimpy.
It definitely is a skimpy record, Your Honor, but going back, that the standard that we're under is plain air.
Mm-hmm.
And there are four requirements for plain air, as I'm sure the court's aware, that it's an air. The government submits that it's not air, that it's not plain or obvious. The third and fourth elements I know this court has struggled with as far as whether it affects the defendant's substantial rights, and that's the third element. With respect to that, this court has said perhaps is it prejudicial to the defendant? Well, certainly any prejudice I don't think is sufficient, because you wouldn't need the word substantial. It would be superfluous if it involved any of his rights. Does it involve important rights as opposed to technical rights for the defendant? Well, it's not specifically technical rights. There are certainly more important rights. This is somewhere in between those, and I think it's closer to the technical rights than to the important rights of perhaps incarceration or the severe restrictions that could be imposed. The district court didn't make specific findings, but there are some general findings that I think are relevant to this particular case. The defendant noted that the district court noted the defendant had a number of adult convictions. I think he has 7 or 8 adult convictions. He was 24 at the time of this particular offense. The district court noted that the seriousness of those convictions was increasing. The district court noted that many of these offenses, like the offense of the bank robbery that he was involved in here, occurred during the time that he was on some type of release. And the court specifically said that that conduct sends a message to the judge that, boy, we better get real serious about this individual. The district court said that the defendant's behavior was out of control, and they wanted to give him an opportunity to turn his life around. I think where the defendant's argument fails is the fourth element. If those first three elements are met, the district court has, or the appellate court, has the ability to exercise its discretion to consider whether or not the particular issue seriously affects public integrity, the fairness, or the reputation of the judicial proceeding. And I don't think that, in this case, that has occurred.
Those statements that you made quoting from the court, I can understand why the education requirement was imposed for the GED, as well as the community service, in light of her language about turning around. It's just that the no alcohol and paying for the alcohol, there's not any real reference to that.
There's certainly much less reference to that, but in the sentence...
Well, she doesn't even mention any of those incidents that you're relying on that were in the PSI.
That's correct. She doesn't mention those, Your Honor, but the sentencing guidelines specifically indicate that an alcohol problem is something that correlates to criminal activity, 5H1.4. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chesley. You have 1 minute, Mr. Cameron.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, it's very possible that Mr. McKissick may benefit from alcohol treatment. It's possible that it would be a waste of time. The fact is that we don't know because it was never addressed in the district court because Mr. McKissick never had notice that that was something that the district court was contemplating. The government has conceded that when Mr. McKissick leaves prison, he would not initially be able to pay for alcohol treatment. Nevertheless, he's subject to the special condition, which requires him not only to receive alcohol treatment, which may be a waste of time, but to actually pay for it. And if he doesn't pay for it, he may be subject to reincarceration.
Can he, though, just make a motion or, you know, get somebody to come back into court and say, please relieve me of the payment obligation for, you know, the next year or whatever while I find a job?
It's very possible he can also raise it on appeal, Your Honor.
He's raising it on appeal, but I'm just saying in terms of these conditions of supervised release, it's not like the door is shut on him to explain his problem to the court. Self-help is what we don't want, but if he goes back to the court and says the payment obligation is too onerous right now, isn't that an avenue?
That is an avenue. That's one avenue, Your Honor. Uh-huh. Of course, the Congress has set up other avenues.
Sure.
One of which
absolutely
is what we're doing here.
Mm-hmm.
I see that my time is over. So, unless Your Honors have questions, I would thank you for your consideration.
Mr. Camarena, you served by appointment of the court in this case, and you have the deep thanks of the court for your fine efforts on behalf of your client.
It's a pleasure, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Indeed, our thanks to both counsel in the case. The case will be taken under advisement.